It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we get a lesson on Wisconsin's lumberjack folklore through history. Now, corn's a big deal in Wisconsin. No surprise. Wisconsin ranks in the top 10 states for corn production, according to a calculation in 2021 by Crop Profit. It's Food Friday. I like corn. I know our next guest likes corn, and maybe you do too. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite way to prepare corn? Do you get excited when sweet corn season is around the corner? Have you been demolishing a lot of it so far this last couple of weeks? Do you have a question about how to cook with it and do maybe more than grilling or boiling? Or is that enough for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Elena Terry is the founder and executive director of Wild Berries, a nonprofit she formed in 2018 to keep First Nation food traditions alive and help community members who are dealing with trauma or addiction. She's also a consulting chef with the Intertribal Agriculture Council. Elena, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
All right, last time I talked to you, it wasn't about corn, but we wrapped up by both talking about how excited we are that corn season was coming. What is it you love about sweet corn this time of year?
Oh my goodness, sweet corn this time of year is incredible. I actually just got done drying a full bushel and then an extra couple bags of sweet corn because it's the best thing to pull out in the winter months for soup. And there's so many different varieties. I was really looking forward to starting to see the colored corn come out. And right now it's kind of at the tail end of its green phase, which means it's still a little milky. And then it starts transitioning into these like bright, beautiful, deep colors where you can start processing it differently and storing it and preserving it differently. So yeah, this time is all about corn.
Let's talk about some of the variety because, you know, you go to the farm stand, generally you find the yellow corn or maybe white kernels. Can you talk about the variety that's out there in the world of corn?
Oh my goodness, there's so much variety. If you talk about corn that's used for cornmeal or flour, or if you have sweet corn, or there's popcorn also. I mean, there's a lot of different varieties of corn, even just varieties of sweet corn. I know here where I'm at this summer, I've had candy corn, honey dip sweet corn, bicolored sweet corn. I mean, there's so many. And part of that, you know, it just brings to the diversity and the beauty of this incredible plant and the way it can really be used for so many different purposes. And it has so many different characteristics based on, you know, those different variations.
As I mentioned, part of Wild Berries' mission is to keep First Nation food traditions alive. Corn, a big part of those traditions over a huge part of this continent, and I guess South America too, maybe. Could you just talk a little bit about the importance of corn?
Absolutely. Corn has its own role in our culture, in our ceremony, in our households even. And it's so valued. You know, I am a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. In Ho-Chunk, there have been certain families who have stewarded specific varieties, say a blue corn or a bronze beauty corn or pure white corn. For hundreds of years, these seeds have been passed down and they've continued to grow them in their purity, you know, with hand pollinating them to make sure that there's not cross-pollination from outside factors that could change the integrity of the genetics. And, you know, I like to think of it as when we plant this traditional and ancestral corn that, I mean, those seeds really are a life. Any seed is a life. And when you plant it, you're helping it fulfill its destiny to become what it was meant to become. And for us, those different corns that are traditional and ancestral, their destiny is to, you know, serve a purpose to provide space in ceremony in our households and to connect us to our ancestors. So it's very, very important for us to have that corn continue to be grown in those ways.
And Elena, you mentioned earlier today, you dried a bunch of corn. I've never done this. I have, you know, I freeze some that I've grilled. I make corn relishes and things like that. What goes into drying a bushel of corn?
I like to, there's a lot of different ways that you could dry it. What I like to do, especially with sweet corn or that milky white green corn that I was talking about, is to parboil it, which means just to bring your water to a boil, to put your corn in there for about 10 minutes or until the color really starts changing. And then you take it out and you take each kernel off of the cob where it's able to maintain its whole shape. And then you can dry it. And it definitely tastes different when you dry it in the sun as opposed to a dehydrator. But I've also found that something like sweet corn, where it does have a higher chance of turning bad quickly because of the sugars that's in it, it's a dehydrator might be the best way to do to dry that corn. But once it's dried, then you can use it for multiple purposes. And it's just an incredible thing, because when you dry it this way with partially boiling it, it's preserved differently. When we dry it on the cob or on the stalk, we could use those kernels for either seed or for nixtamalization in transforming that corn. When we parboil it, it's more specifically for culinary purposes only.
All right. This was a new word for me, nixtamalization. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a big word. It's a mouthful to try and say, but it's the process of liming the corn or bringing an acidic pH to the corn to help process some of those toxins that are in it and to soften the outside hull of the corn so that the part that you wouldn't digest. And it also releases nutrients that are in there. So it's a crucial process to do when you're transforming corn or preserving it in different ways, or if you're using it to cook with, because without nixtamalization, it can actually be toxic to your body. So, but when you do that process of adding lye or sometimes I think there's a sodium bicarbonate or something that you can add to it, we use hardwood ash. In its purest form, we'll actually have a fire and keep the ash and then, you know, use that until we're through with it and then use another fire with the sole intention of having that ash to nixtamalize the corn. And so, yeah, it's another part. It's something that you would do if you were, say, making masa or if you were using fresh tortillas, you might want to nixtamalize your corn right before you do that.
We're talking to Elena Terry on this edition of Food Friday, founder and executive director of Wild Berries. We are cooking with corn, talking about corn traditions, different ways to use it. You could join in with your own favorites, your questions. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I've often heard you mention, Rob, that you like to make soup.
Oh, yeah.
And I do also. I'm a real soup lover. I feel deprived, actually, if I don't have soup every day. But what I'm calling to tell you is that as opposed to talking about sweet corn right now, what I'm talking about is using 2 cans of creamed corn. If you're going to make potato soup, leek soup, tomato, squash, even chicken noodle, any kind of soup, if you start with 2 cans of creamed corn, there is a richness to that soup that it just improves any soup immeasurably. And I'm thinking that you would like to know that because you're a soup lover as I am.
I love making soup.
It thickens the soup and it riches the taste just tremendously.
Nancy, thank you so much for that advice. And Elena, that reminds me of something you teased last time we were on that I wanted to ask you about today. Grating a corn cob that I think you end up using in soup or creamed corn. Do I remember that right?
Yes, that's a great way to do it. If you have fresh sweet corn and you grate that into a bowl, then you have the corn starch, the sugar, and the texture of that fresh corn. And then what I like to do is start my stock with those cobs, what's remaining, because there's so much flavor in the cobs, and then add basically that raw creamed corn stock to the base that you started, and you can just get an incredible depth of corn flavor there as well.
All right, you grate the corn, and then you put the corn cob in the stock whole. Is that right?
Yes. Okay, and then you can pull that out later, but it's an incredible base to a vegetable stock or any type of soup stock.
Nancy, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Elena Terry, founder and executive director of Wild Berries, about cooking with corn. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite way to grill corn, to boil corn, to cook it off the cob? Favorite things to serve it with or in? Recipes you like to use? Or do you have a question for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow your own? Did you grow heirloom varieties? Definitely love to hear from you. If so, 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Elena Terry, founder and executive director of the nonprofit Wild Berries. Elena's talking to us about different ways to prepare and cook with corn. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a big fan of corn? Do you look forward to sweet corn season each year? Do you have a favorite recipe, a favorite thing, a way you like to use it in your cooking? Do you have a question for our guest? Do you preserve corn? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Joe is with us in Taylor. Joe, hello.
Hi.
What'd you want to bring up, Joe?
Well, I was wondering what the drying techniques of on the cob versus through the kernels, like if you leave it on the cob or if you just put it out in the sun.
Oh, interesting. Joe, thanks for the call. So on the cob or off the cob for drying, Elena?
Well, it would depend a little bit on what you wanted your end result to be. You would want to leave it on the cob to dry if you're going to, say, grind that up and use it for cornmeal. Or if you're going to use it for seed, then you'd want it to stay on the cob. If you want to maybe use it for the culinary purposes, then I would say do the parboil and then dry it off of the cob. If you cook it at all, you want to take it off of the cob because that cob is going to hold on to the moisture, and it's going to kind of inhibit the drying process. So if you have it on the cob, then it's kind of kept in its state on the stalk drying. And if you take it off of the stalk and you cook it at all, then you want to take those kernels off of the cob before you dry it.
All right, Joe. Happy drying. Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Lou joins us next in Bayfield. Lou, what did you want to bring up?
Hey there. Have you ever tried elote, Mexican street corn? That is the best.
I have, Lou. And I got to say, I just had it in the last few years. I was kind of like hurt and offended because nobody told me about it like decades ago. It's so good. Do you have a favorite way to eat it, or where did you run across it?
Well, my son, one of my adult sons, he says, yeah, Mom, you should try elote, street corn, Mexican street corn. I said, okay, well, let me know how to do it. And since I'm vegan, I use my vegan mayonnaise, Hellman's mayonnaise, and I do it that way. And it works just fine. It tastes the same. And vegan mayonnaise, vegan mayonnaise, Hellman's mayonnaise, and then really any vegan butter. But let your viewer or let your listeners know, you know, how to do it, what the process is. Or do you know how to?
Lou, I've kind of winged it and made up my own street corn. You just cook the corn and then mix it up. I like it with grilled corn, mix it up with, like you say, mayo and lime and spices. And there's lots of different varieties I've seen at restaurants. Elena, do you have any thoughts on elote, Mexican street corn?
It is one of my favorites. I mean, how can you not like that? It's the perfect combination of sweet and salty, creamy, and a little bit of texture. If you use cotija cheese or tajin to add a little bit of extra spice to it. I know some like theirs a little bit spicier, and I've even seen them crunch up flaming hot Cheetos and put those on the outside of the street corn. So people are getting really inventive with how they add flavor and texture to it. But I mean, how you can't go wrong with sweet corn, mayonnaise, butter, cheese, lime, and salt and seasonings.
Yeah, that's, I got to admit, that's something I've intended to do this year and haven't done it so far. But I've got a bunch of grilled corn now in the freezer, so I've got time. Great. That's a great suggestion, Lou. Thanks for calling in at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. We're talking about corn with Elena Terry from the group Wild Berries. Back to your calls now. We've got Don with us in Bayfield County. Don, hi.
Hi, Don. Hey, when I was a young lad, all the corn that we used to get was golden yellow corn, and you can't find it anymore. It's all bicolored corn.
Oh, yeah, the yellow and white stuff. I feel like I still run into both, Elena. You go beyond the yellow and white, but have you noticed a long-term trend like Don has seen?
I kind of have seen that there is more bicolored sweet corn, but I also have noticed that there's some incredibly sweet hybrid corn that's been introduced. Like I mentioned, the candy corn or the honey-dipped sweet corn, and those are pretty universally yellow. So I think that it just depends on where you're getting it from and who's growing what varieties.
Don, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jonathan joins us now in Madison. Jonathan, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I just wanted to bring up nixtamalization and talk a little bit more about that, because I think tortillas and masa are probably one of the most integral parts of corn usage. I know we're not in like dry corn season yet, but the uses for masa, from atole to tostadas to tortillas to tamales, it's so versatile. And like atole, for instance, you can actually use fresh masa in like for beverages or soups as a thickening agent, and it creates a really nice viscosity and adds really nice flavor. So yeah, I just wanted to highlight nixtamalization a little bit more.
Jonathan, you sound like a pro. Do you make your own tortillas and the other things you were talking about?
I actually do, and actually Elena and I are friends through the through the culinary industry. I will say I do own and operate a tortilleria in Madison.
Excellent. Jonathan, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that with us. Yeah, corn, obviously super versatile, Elena. Jonathan mentioning tortillas and a couple other things we haven't gotten into yet.
Yeah, Jonathan is incredible. So if you're in Madison, try and check out his operation down there, because it is so amazing, corn, and it can be transformed into so many different ways. And when you add that process of nixtamalization, you really do open up like this incredible culinary world of flavor and texture and different varying end products. So I think that you know, the more you talk about it and the more you're able to have access to things that have been hand processed, like the tortillas and stuff that Jonathan does, then the more you're able to appreciate the flavor in its pure form, the way that it was intended to be, you know, tasted. And when you really can taste that corn, it's incredible. And there's such a diversity in the flavor profiles that even each strain of corn provides, let alone the textures or even how long you wait to mill the corn after you nixtamalize it, or if you refrigerate it. I mean, there's so many different ways that you can transform corn that, I mean, it's incredible. And I would just really encourage people to try doing it in a little bit more of diverse ways, or to go and get some of those products that have had that hand care and authenticity incorporated into the preparation of it, because you can't really duplicate that in, you know, mass produced product.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for that call. Okay, I want to stay with nixtamalization a little bit longer here. If I wanted to try it at home, you kind of talked through some of the basics earlier, Elena, you know, not buying any special stuff. Like, what would be the easiest way for me to nixtamalize my corn?
You'd have to start with your product that needs to be nixtamalized. So you would have to get the corn that is dried,
okay,
like the whole kernels that are dried. And, you know, I think that for me, I would only want to recommend that you be able to do that on an outdoor fire, you know, open fire, where you soak it and you rinse it and you wash it, and then you add your hardwood ash to the corn in a pot and you cook it until it really does start to pop open. I mean, you can take it to different levels of opening based on what you want your end product to be. So sometimes we partially do it for preservation purposes, and then we finish cooking it when we rehydrate it. And sometimes we completely open it up, grind it for hominy or to make product like tortillas. So I would probably recommend to see what you wanted to do with your end product and then take your corn to that stage. And I think the best part is we are entering a time where there will be plenty of corn available if you wanted to, you know, experiment with the process and with what your end result would be, is that now is the time to be able to get the supplies to do that. And like, what an exciting thing to try at home.
All right, now I want to take things to super basics here, Elena. Grilled or boiled, I'm a butter and salt guy, and that's it. If you're eating corn on the cob, do you have any condiments on it? Straight up, what do you like to do?
So we just had some fresh sweet corn that we grilled up at the Monongah Market in Mackinac City, and they produce maple syrup there. So we mixed maple syrup with real butter and took the fat solids out of the butter and dipped the sweet corn in there as soon as it came off of the grill and finished it with a little sprinkle of salt. And that was incredible. I myself ate, I think I ate 3 ears of my own corn because I was like, oh man, I just wanted to really try a little bit more of it. So I would say that if you like something sweet like that and adding a little bit of sweetness to it, it's always good to add like that fresh lime. There's a reason why it's so popular. That acid gives a nice complement to, you know, the sweetness of the corn. But I think it's really important too to keep the simplicity of the ingredients, especially when it is something as beautiful as corn, and not to overpower it with adding a whole lot, unless of course you're making that elotes, because it's just the perfect bite there.
Elena, we'll leave it there. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, happy eating with corn. Great conversation with you, as always.
That's Elena Terry, founder and executive director of Wild Berries. You can keep sharing your corn-related favorites and recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Speaking of corn, an image of an ear of corn might make some Wisconsin quarters worth more than 25 cents. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, an online video has been making the rounds about the state-themed Wisconsin U.S. quarter released in 2004. Turns out a number of those quarters were minted with a flaw in the image. Now it shows a cow, some cheese, and an ear of corn. And in the misprinted quarters, the ear of corn has an extra leaf on the side. Okay, it's not the most exciting thing, but that flaw can make the quarter worth extra money. The video highlights a mint condition bad corn quarter selling for $2,000. Don't start spending that money just yet. The price is way down now that people know what they're looking for. Still, it might be worth a quick look through that pocket full of change or bucket of change while you're waiting for your corn to get done. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, elections are on the way and new court rulings have changed voting regulations. Find out what you need to know about your ballot. Now from tall tales to big legends, Wisconsin's got a few. The heyday of the lumberjack era in the state gave rise to a lot of folklore and mythology, strange woodland creatures, supernatural feats of strength, and our next guest has been tracking these tales down. Chad Lewis is a paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer from Eau Claire. He joined us to talk about the stories he's found. Here's that conversation. You are from Sawdust City, originally Eau Claire, a strong connection to the lumber industry. Can you talk about the importance of timber to the city and the state as a whole?
Yes. Well, of course, Eau Claire was known as Sawdust City because of all the lumber mills we had in our town. And we weren't alone. Almost every city along a river had one or more sawmills, and those sawmills fed the lumber industry, but also many other industries, broom making, tools. I think today many people forget how important the lumber industry was to shaping not only Wisconsin, but the entire country.
And you're giving a virtual talk this evening for the Shawano Public Library about the legends that came out of this. How big a source of our folklore and legend was lumberjacking here in the state?
It's amazing. Charles E. Brown, the late great Wisconsin folklorist, wrote in the early 1900s about Paul Bunyan stories. And imagine, you work from the time when it's too dark to see until you can't see at night, and all you could do is come back to the bunkhouse, sit around in your bunk with all the other lumberjacks and spin tall tales and tell yarns. So that's what they did for their entertainment, trying to one-up each other on who could tell the best tale. And that really grew a whole myth of monsters, legends, and just craziness in the Northwoods where anything could happen.
Well, one tale that kept growing bigger and bigger in the telling was Paul Bunyan and his big blue ox, Babe, kind of a well-known figure. I think Minnesota has some claim to him, too. Are there parts of that legend that people might not be as familiar with?
Yes, of course, we claim in Wisconsin to be the home of Paul Bunyan, but so does Minnesota, Michigan, Vermont, the country of Canada, and a few other states. But we all know Paul was from Wisconsin. And most people don't know how Paul met Babe. And he actually met Babe in the terrible winter of the blue snow. And it was blue snow because it was so cold that everybody was cursing up a blue streak and it turned all the snow blue. It was so cold that winter that fish grew fur. That's how cold it was when Paul found Babe in the snow. And he had already turned blue from the blue snow, so Paul took him into his lumber camp. And like everything around Paul Bunyan, Babe grew to an enormous size, and the two went on to make history.
And that speaks to, I think, some of the creativity of the people in this line of work and probably others. The it was so cold, how cold was it sort of things you just came up with. We rely on, you know, professionals create stuff for us. Back then, it might have been just people sitting around in that lumber shack.
And no two Paul Bunyan or lumberjack stories were the same. They were always changing, always morphing, progressing, and I think getting a little bit better. And oftentimes that was the creativity of the lumberjack, especially when the greenhorns, the rookies, came into the lumber camp. They would try to scare them or initiate them by telling the weirdest tales they could.
And now you mentioned the monsters that were invented. Now, the Hodag is a famous one. I know that was kind of invented for publicity purposes. I think we've talked to you about the Hodag before, Chad. Remind us of the story of the Hodag. And was it a big lumber one?
It was. Back in the 1800s, Eugene Shepherd out of Rhinelander area went into the woods and saw this hideous monster that looked somewhat like a dragon, a huge beast with spikes down its back, huge claws, long fangs, and he eventually captured this Hodag and brought it to the Rhinelander area, put it on display at carnivals and county fairs until people found out it was a hoax, and then he admitted that he hoaxed it, but he said the only reason he hoaxed it was because he wasn't able to capture it. It was so dangerous out in the woods, and believe it or not, more people showed up to see how he had hoaxed it than when they thought it was real. And the town of Rhinelander now embraces it. It's their sporting team mascots. They have a huge display of the Hodag out in front of their visitors bureau. So it's a fun tale.
The Hodag wasn't the only creature out there, was it? What other kind of things did lumberjacks scare the greenhorns with?
One of my favorites is the snow snake. Unlike other snakes, this snake hibernates all summer long. It only comes out after the first snow. It migrated here years ago from Siberia. And it's pure white, so you can't see it on the snow. So it would bite you and you would die, but not from the poisonous venom. You would freeze to death. And there was only one antidote, one cure for the bite from a snow snake, and that was huge amounts of liquor. So much that they recommended that by the time you're falling off of your bar stool and you're seeing things, you're probably in the clear from the snow snake.
I'm going to go out on a limb, Chad, and say there were some lumberjacks who took the treatment, what do they call it, prophylactically in advance of that snow snake bite, if you take my meaning.
Well, that's the beauty is a lot of these lumber camps, alcohol was not allowed. So it was a big deal. So I think a lot of them probably invented getting bit by the snow snake. And as you said, some of them probably took the aspirin before the headache.
Now, do you have a favorite story from lumberjack legend outside of course, the Paul Bunyan legend?
I do. And my favorites are the real stories of the lumberjacks. And one of my interest in the lumberjack era was when these men died. And it was always the men because the men would leave for the winter and go into these lumber camps. And many of them were farmers. And it was the most dangerous job in America. Mm-hmm. Imagine these huge trees, but then also bringing it down to the rivers, waiting for the snow melt, and then putting them in the water and bringing them down to the lumber towns. So a lot of the lumberjacks died. And if they were lucky, they would be buried in a barrel or a couple big pieces of bark around them as a makeshift coffin, and they'd be buried in the ground. Others would then just have their boots tied to a tree. They would nail their boots up to a tree of someone who had died. So if you're ever out in the woods or along a riverbank and you see boots nailed to a tree, it might be a lumberjack. But I love those stories because many of these people were unknown. They didn't get a funeral service. They didn't get a proper burial. They might not even known their name. They might have just went by Madison Mike or something of that nature. So I'm fascinated how both the real folklore melds with the not so real folklore.
And you're Chad Lewis, so I got to ask, are there paranormal stories, ghostly hauntings and things like that associated with the lumberjack era?
Well, the lumberjacks reported a lot of what we would consider today to be Bigfoot sightings. They didn't call it Bigfoot back then, of course, but they talked about these hairy, giant creatures roaming the woods. And back in those days, the big woods had endless possibilities. If you believed, you know, the Hodag was running around, why couldn't this giant gorilla type thing be running around? So I'm still finding more and more real reports, at least the reports were real, of Bigfoot type creatures. They also believed in the Willow of the Wisp, these balls of light, swamp gases, we might call them, that would plague a lumber camp during the summer months as well.
Why do you enjoy sharing these stories of Wisconsin's folklore and legends past with new generations, Chad?
One, they're amazingly fun. They're just so much fun to research and to add your own spin to them. But two, it keeps the lumber era alive in our memory of how much this played in Wisconsin's industry and how it shaped the lives of so many people. So many men were able to buy their farms and their property from working the winters in the lumber camps. And I think that's a history that should not be forgotten. It's only 100 years ago, but yet most people, we have no clue about it.
And give us a sneak preview, Chad. What are you researching right now, maybe for future talks?
I'm doing a finishing up a book on supernatural dares, where places that have a supernatural reputation where you have to do something for the legend to come true, like sit in the devil's chair or knock three times on a cursed mausoleum to release the spirit. All these things that you got to test your bravery to go do.
That sounds fun. We'll talk to you about it, I'm sure. Chad, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Keep an eye out.
That's Eau Claire's own Chad Lewis, paranormal researcher, author, and lecturer. We talked to him earlier this year about Wisconsin's lumberjack legends. Coming up, we talk about two recent court decisions that will affect midterm election voting here in Wisconsin. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. This week, we saw a pair of decisions that could have an impact on how people vote and whether those votes are counted in this fall's midterm elections in Wisconsin. They relate to clerks filling in missing info on absentee ballot witness certificates and clerks allowing voters with disabilities to get help in returning their absentee ballots. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following either or both of those storylines? Do either of them affect you? do you work in a clerk's office on elections? How do these decisions affect you and what you have to do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson has been covering these and other election stories. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob.
Let's start with this decision that affects voters with disabilities. The Wisconsin Elections Commission voted Tuesday. It's the latest in a long step. Get us up to speed on the road to that decision.
It is a long road whenever you're talking about these election lawsuits. I think when you're looking at how we got there in the short term, the Elections Commission got to the point that it did this week because a federal judge told them to. A federal judge said that what you're doing right now when it comes to disabled voters and their ability to get assistance turning in absentee ballots violates federal law. The longer answer is you got to look back to the decision that the Wisconsin Supreme Court issued earlier this year when it said that absentee ballot drop boxes are not allowed in Wisconsin. In that same ruling, the court's majority said that it's illegal for someone else, like a spouse or a roommate, to return a voter's completed absentee ballot to the clerk's office. So that's where these disabled voters got involved and said, you're basically making me choose between my right to vote and, you know, my health, and in some cases making it just practically impossible for me to return my absentee ballot because I can't do it on my own. A federal judge agreed, told the Elections Commission you better fix this, and so they came up with new guidance for clerks that says, here's what you're supposed to do.
All right. What are they supposed to do?
It's pretty unequivocal in the language that the Elections Commission passed on a 4-2 vote. It says that pursuant to the Voting Rights Act, any Wisconsin voter who requires assistance with mailing or delivering their absentee ballot to the municipal clerk because of a disability must be permitted to receive such assistance by a person of the voter's choice, aside from the person's employer or union. And then there's, a lot of questions and answers for clerks. Do I need to confirm someone's disability if they're being provided voting assistance? The answer is no. Essentially every question leads to clerks to, take the path of assuming that when somebody comes in and says, I am helping a disabled voter cast their absentee ballot, you accept it and you don't ask questions, basically. I mean, you ask minimal questions. The presumption is that voters are doing the right thing here.
As you mentioned, it was a 4-2 vote, meaning two members of the Elections Commission didn't agree with it. I've seen some other pushback. What kind of criticism have we seen of this, the way they've chosen to enact the federal judge's policy?
Yeah, on that particular motion, there were a couple of Republican appointees on the commission, Don Millis the other Republican appointee whose name is escaping me right at this moment. But they were basically saying, it was Bob Spindell, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. They were both saying that there needs to be some sort of kind of verification that somebody who's coming in or not verification, but just some sort of a record where they say, I am doing this. Yes, I am helping a disabled voter. And then you'd have their name, address, things like that. But that's not required, was the argument of Democrat Ann Jacobs under federal law. She's saying, if you do that, you're creating a new hurdle because the federal law, when it comes to the rights of disabled people to vote, does not require that. So we shouldn't do it either.
Now, there's been a lot of things in election law over the years where it looks like we're done. Is this the last word on this, Sean, or is it possible somebody could take this to, another court somewhere?
I've learned to just never say never, something like this. It seems like we're always swimming in court when it comes to voting laws, voting guidance, voting rules. And because the commission passed this as guidance, mm-hmm. but it is, pretty, firm direction toward clerks. It's not wishy-washy in any way. This is the Elections Commission taking a stand, basically. You could imagine somebody taking it to court and saying, hey, the Elections Commission exceeded its authority here and, should have gone to the legislature first, something like that. It's just that's not happening at the moment.
So for a voter with a disability right now, the rule is, yes, you may send your ballot with someone else you designate to take it in. They can drop it off without filling out paperwork for you.
Yeah, that's right. And also, people can also get help putting it in the mail too, mm-hmm. where, you know, the rules on that are maybe a little less clear in the Wisconsin Supreme Court's decision on drop boxes, but they didn't say you couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the latest court-related decisions related to how we vote this November. Okay, let's turn to part two of our conversation. Filling in missing info. Now, this is on a very particular document that's gotten a lot of attention, Sean. What is that question with this? Can clerks fill in some info here?
So when you vote absentee, you have a witness to witness that you're voting absentee, right? And they fill out a certificate with their name, address, etc. And what the Wisconsin Elections Commission guidance had been on witness certificates, this dates back to 2016, is that if a clerk can determine if there's missing information, like somebody didn't fill in their municipality or their
zip code.
Anything that the clerk can look at and say, I know what that is and I can fix it, they were directed to do that. They are directed to fill in that information. They're not touching the ballot. They're dealing with the certificate. And the idea behind this policy is that it would reduce the likelihood that somebody would be accidentally disenfranchised. You know, this is not a case where the voter was doing something wrong. It was the certificate was filled out wrong by their witness. And so the thought was, when a clerk knows these are mistakes, the clerk can fix it. So this is a policy that in 2016 passed 6-0, meaning all three Democrats, all three Republicans on this elections commission agreed to this idea, which is kind of rare nowadays when it comes to voting stuff on this same commission. But back then, it was something that everybody supported. That unanimous support slipped away somewhere around, I don't know, after the 2020 election in the lawsuit filed by former President Donald Trump's campaign. It was one of the categories of voters that his campaign said had not been cast legally, you know, they were arguing that because this is not explicitly authorized in Wisconsin statute, the Elections Commission can't just do it. And so you should strike these votes. The Supreme Court didn't rule on that, but the Supreme Court did dismiss the former president's lawsuit because it was filed after the election. And essentially, the majority's take was you don't change the rules of the game after it's done.
And so what does this ruling now from a judge, a Waukesha County judge, mean? It's just now clerks can't touch that witness address on the form.
That is what it means, yes. Mm-hmm. However, this, you could imagine, is going mm-hmm. to be appealed. And so the Wisconsin Supreme Court is all but certain to have another crack at this and decide, you know, what to do on this going forward. There's going to be a motion hearing in this this particular case on Monday, where people who want to appeal this case are going to ask the judge to stay his ruling, meaning put this on pause while we appeal this thing because this is a big deal. But I don't know that the judge is going to go along with that. If he doesn't, then the Elections Commission is going to have to tell clerks next week, hey, you can't. The judge says you can't do this. The judge says this is not law. I think this is actually potentially a big deal because you're talking about potentially thousands of voters based on an audit of this practice in the 2020 election. If you extrapolate it to a whole state, you're talking about potentially like 7% of absentee votes could have been tossed out because they were missing information on this certificate.
Now, in your reporting on this, you go back to that state Supreme Court decision, Justice Hagedorn, Brian Hagedorn, raise the philosophical question basically of what is an address? Like if I just put my street address and not the zip code, do they throw it out? Or, you know, I put an address, like it's not necessarily a slam dunk that votes that don't get filled in would necessarily be rejected.
Yeah, he asked a lot of questions in that opinion and kind of just decided not to answer them there. While the world has surely faced more pressing questions, Hagedorn wrote at the time, the contours of what makes an address has real impact. And so he is looking at these particulars and what happens if you have all this stuff, but you don't have the zip code. And what he's saying is that Wisconsin law is not clear on that point. So you could argue that like Wisconsin law says don't fill this information in, but Wisconsin law doesn't really say what's an address when it comes to what's okay for this certificate. Brian Hagedorn's opinions on these things are extremely consequential in Wisconsin because he is the definition of a swing justice in our state. And, you know, how he views what an address is here in the year 2022 could very well decide this issue going forward.
And I guess the takeaway lesson here for absentee voters is get that witness to fill in the whole darn thing, zip code and all, to be on the safe side.
Put all the details. That would be the, yes, that's great advice. Make sure you fill in your name, address, municipality, state, zip code, all that stuff. Put it on there so there's no doubt.
Write small, I understand. Sean, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR Capital Bureau Chief, with us looking at recent decisions affecting Wisconsin voters with disabilities and that guidance on missing info on witness certificates on absentee ballots. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, big heat waves in parts of the U.S. are putting strain on the energy grid, adding to heat wave risks. A Wisconsin grid expert joins the show. Tell us what's going on and how to fix it. That's Monday here on Central Time.